Today on the 21st, this weekend saw continued demonstrations over the killing of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and other acts of police violence. We'll talk to reporters across Illinois about what they saw.
They spray painted a police wagon and tried almost toppled it.
Then, in many newsrooms, it started with temporary pay cuts or furloughs to weather the economic storm of the pandemic. But now, communities are facing a permanent void of local journalism at a time when that work is more critical than ever. And Chicago-based astronomer Lucianne Walkowicz has filed a trademark lawsuit against Mattel and American Girl, alleging the toy maker stole their likeness. I'm Brian Mackey. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WCBU in Peoria, and WNIJ in DeKalb. But first, the news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. It's been 1 week since George Floyd died with a Minneapolis police officer kneeling on his neck. Four officers on the scene were fired the next day, and by Friday, one of them had been charged with murder and manslaughter. Protests have been erupting all over the country, including in multiple cities in Illinois, Chicago, Aurora, Springfield, Peoria, Belleville, and more. In places, there was looting and violence as well. As we'll hear, some of that seemed to be linked to elements of the demonstrations, but in other cases, local officials have said it's been opportunistic, and protest organizers have sought to distance themselves from that activity. This is a fast-moving situation, and we'll continue to bring you updates and more in-depth conversation about not just the protests and violence, but the legacy of racism in America that led to this moment. For now, we're going to talk to several reporters around Illinois who've been reporting on what happened this weekend. Earlier this morning, I spoke with Matt Harvey from The Tribe, a Chicago-based digital media outlet aiming to, in its own description, reshape the narrative of Black Chicago. Matt was covering the protests in downtown Chicago on Saturday and Sunday. We spoke via Zoom. Matt, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, of course. Thank you for having me on.
So, Saturday. Let's start with Saturday night. I wonder if you can begin by telling me what was the vibe like in the, you know, in the afternoon protests, and then as sun starts to set, the city issues the curfew. You know, do things change? Take us there.
Yeah. It started around 2 p.m. was when I got there. It was at that point, I felt like the name of the game was noise. It was just protesters trying to, you know, basically make themselves heard vocally, playing. A lot of people had instruments and cars were honking horns. The people driving that were out there in support. It was pretty gridlocked, but at that point, it was maybe, I'd say, about 2,000-3,000 people gathered downtown at Daly Plaza. And then a little bit later, they started to migrate towards the bridge. The bridge that crosses over to the other side of the river where Magnificent Mile is, and also the other side of the river where the or Trump Tower is. Mm-hmm. And that was when it started to get really contentious between police and protesters. That was when the police started to barricade people who were on the bridge already. It wouldn't allow them back off of it. The protesters ended up pushing back and the police retreated a little bit. That was around the time when it really started to become vandalism of like cars, police cars. They spray painted a police wagon and tried almost toppled it. And from there, like as nightfall came, that was when things really descended into real chaos. The looting had started around 5, so there was still daylight. Hmm. But it was around like I'd say 8, 9 was when we really saw like major damage being done to pretty much most stores, most major establishments. These are places like Neiman Marcus, like Macy's, like the Nike store downtown, the major mall downtown, the Water Tower place. All these places were ransacked. And that was, and from there, it really descended into chaos. And the mayor ended up imposing a curfew at 9 p.m. that night.
And do you have a sense, and I know it can be so hard to tell when you're on the ground, but were the people who were, you know, protesting and making noise, is that the same people who were doing the damage? Or did it seem like you know, because we've heard in other places about, you know, outsiders coming in and things like that.
Yeah, I'd say that it was honestly a mix. I can't say that there. So most of the people that were there that ended up looting, were a lot of them were there earlier on for the protest. But there were definitely more people that entered the city, that entered Michigan Avenue specifically, that came to loot. Because while protests were going on the other side of the bridge, and while protests were honestly marching from down Lakeshore Drive, there were a lot of people that were already looting stores who had most likely come down there from different directions just to get down Michigan Avenue to get to those stores. I'd say that it was, there were definitely some people who came down there just for looting.
And what kind of, you described a little bit already, but what kind of interactions did you see between police and protesters? Were the police being violent or were they more restrained? I did notice you had a tweet as people were going into Macy's. You said the police were posted up just up the block and didn't seem to be doing anything to try and stop it. But
yeah, and that was what you saw a lot when it came to the looting, especially. And it was interesting to me because it seemed like the police were way more combatant with the protesters that were not looting rather than the ones that the people that were down there that were. So I had seen a few stores, the entire Magnificent Mile where all these shopping these stores are, there were a lot of people looting those stores, and all the way on the end of the block about where the bridge is lifted up, that was where all the police were just stationed, just sitting there. And honestly, it was interesting to watch, and not something I expected, but it seemed to be that they just didn't care to stop the looting at that point. Something that I've heard a lot of is that they were not ordered to do it because they know that a lot of these stores have insurance on the things that they have. So if anything would happen, these stores are reimbursed. So it wasn't worth the police lending their abilities to that. But when it came, it was a lot more contentious, honestly, when it came to the protesters who were marching the streets that weren't looting. They were tear gas thrown a couple times. There were some rubber bullets used. Pepper spray was definitely used. And you could smell it in the air. I definitely inhaled a bit of pepper spray and found myself coughing a lot when I was down there because of that. And so it was interesting to me to see they were a lot more aggressive, it felt like, with protesters that were not actually looting.
Matt Harvey is a reporter with a Chicago-based news outlet, The Tribe. Matt, thanks so much for taking the time out of your day to be with us, and stay safe out there.
Of course. I appreciate it. I appreciate that.
All right. I spoke with Matt earlier this morning. We're back live now with two other reporters who've been covering these events. Stacey St. Clair is with the Chicago Tribune. She was covering peaceful demonstrations in Aurora and the destructive rioting that came later in the day. Stacey, thanks for being on with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Kelsey Landis is with the Belleville News Democrat. She was covering protests in the Metro East region this weekend. Kelsey, thank you for being here as well.
Hi, Brian. Good to be here. Thanks.
So, Stacey, I'm going to begin with you. Can you start by taking us to the peaceful demonstrations in Aurora? You reported that the mayor even joined in with the demonstrators.
The police chief in Aurora, Kristen Zeman, even invited protesters to come to the police station where she met with them. She chanted "Justice Now" alongside them. And then took questions about issues like wearing body cameras and minority hiring in her department. But throughout the peaceful protests, there were definitely two factions there. There was a group that wanted the nonviolent protest, who wanted to engage local police in conversation. And then there was another more hostile group who clearly wanted to take more aggressive action. At one point, the two groups broke off and the peaceful march headed into the downtown where the more hostile group, I guess I would describe them as, headed toward the outlet mall on sort of the outskirts of town. And they arrived there to find that surrounded and blocked off by police. So then much of that group headed into Aurora's downtown, where they began looting. They set three police cars on fire and burned other buildings. And in response, police began firing tear gas and rubber bullets into the crowd.
Wow. And thank you for correcting me. I have your story right in front of me. I don't know why I said the mayor. It does say the police chief.
He was there too.
Yeah. Okay. And Kelsey, I want to ask you about, where did you start out covering this weekend? I know you covered one in Edwardsville. Can you take us to the scene there?
Sure. So, you know, the weekend in the Metro East really started off on Friday night with people going back to the restaurants where, you know, streets were shut down and people were enjoying the nice weather. But that was really juxtaposed with the protests that began in the Metro East on Saturday. One of the first ones was in East St. Louis, where a group of faith-based protesters were out mourning the loss of those in the Black community who have died of COVID-19. And also protesting the death of George Floyd. And then that, you know, that led into Sunday in Edwardsville, where between 250 and 300 people turned out in Edwardsville, which is a predominantly white community, which I talked to a resident who grew up in Edwardsville, and he said he had never seen anything like it in his hometown. The demonstration was peaceful. There were no visible uniformed police officers there, although some of the protesters speculated that there was plainclothes officers there. But it was peaceful. And I talked to the police chief in Edwardsville, and he told me that those protesters were welcome to stay there as long as they wanted to have their voices heard. And that's what they did. There were a couple of instances where people driving by shouted some obscenities, and the protesters, a couple, threw water bottles at their cars. But the organizers of the protest quickly shut that down and reminded people to stay calm and to stay peaceful. And that's what they did. And we expect more protests in the Metro East, potentially throughout the week and very likely next weekend as well, this coming weekend.
And so there wasn't, I mean, what sort of interactions did you see, Kelsey, in terms of between police and protesters? I mean, in some places we were seeing reports of tear gas and rubber bullets being used. Did anything like that happen in Metro East?
That was not the case in the Metro East, although across the river in Ferguson, you did see tear gas being deployed against demonstrators on Saturday night, where demonstrators gathered in front of the Ferguson police station. And even then, there weren't any arrests. There was tear gas deployed against them, but it largely remained peaceful. And then I think there were only 6 arrests last night in Ferguson Sunday night. So in the Metro East, they remain peaceful. In Ferguson, Missouri, there was some violence and some destruction. But as far as the Metro East, things remain pretty calm.
Yeah. And of course, just reminding listeners who probably don't need the reminder, but Ferguson is where Michael Brown was killed, 6-7 years ago now, and kicking off the sort of nationwide Black Lives Matter protests and movement. Mm-hmm. Stacey, I wonder, we've heard, obviously, these protests are taking place amid a pandemic. I wonder, was that a concern among any of the protesters or anybody on site? Or is that something that people just put out of their mind? This is too urgent of a thing, and people kind of, are setting that aside for now.
Well, I'll tell you whose mind it was on. And that was the business owners who've been out of, who've been closed for 2 months during this pandemic, and they were set to reopen if they hadn't just reopened on Friday. And now one business owner said, I lost 2 months of business, and it's going to take another 2 months to get this store back and running again, if I can get it running again at all. It's also, officials have mentioned Governor Pritzker asked yesterday for people who participated in the protests, the both the peaceful ones and the unrest later, to quarantine them, self-quarantine, the next several days. And another fallout in Aurora was they closed COVID testing today. Aurora had one of the regional testing sites that was open to anybody who said they had symptoms, and now people who have symptoms can't go get tested at that site. So yeah, there's definitely a domino effect that's connected to the pandemic.
And just about a minute left, but Stacey, I wonder if, I mean, we're talking about this, you know, protests. Is there more to come? And I think is interesting. I lost my train of thought there for a second. We're used to seeing protests in big cities, places like downtown Chicago, certainly after Laquan McDonald was killed a number of years ago. But I don't think people are as used to seeing it in the suburbs. Is this unusual in your experience?
I mean, this level of violence is definitely unusual, this level of looting. And it wasn't just Aurora. There were other North Riverside, which is closer to the city, and Waukegan, which is north of the city. They both had violent unrest last night. And I think there are concerns. A lot of suburbs shut down last night as they were trying to reopen. So I don't think police believe that they've escaped danger yet.
Okay. Stacey St. Clair is a reporter with the Chicago Tribune. We also spoke with Kelsey Landis from the Belleville News Democrat. Thank you both so much for taking time out of your day to speak with us.
Thank you for having me.
You are listening to The 21st. Coming up after the break, newsrooms around the country are starting with temporary pay cuts and furloughs to try and weather this storm of a pandemic. But now some are closing up shop entirely as their work is needed more than ever. That conversation after a short break on The 21st. Stay with us. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Newsrooms around the country are closing up shop. In many places, it started with temporary pay cuts or furloughs to try and weather the economic storm of the COVID-19 pandemic. But now, many communities are facing a permanent void when it comes to local news coverage. And this comes amid rising tensions around Illinois and around the country because of the killing of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and others. And as we discussed on the show earlier, and because of the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. It's a time when people are relying on local reporters for critical information. Kristen Hare covers local news innovation at Pointer, a nonprofit journalism institute and media research organization. She's been tracking furloughs, layoffs, and pay cuts in the news industry. Kristen, welcome to The 21st.
Thanks so much for having me.
We're also joined by Dave Heinzman from the Chicago Tribune. He covers issues related to government, politics, and crime. He's also on the paper's Union Bargaining Committee, which negotiated furloughs there. David, welcome to The 21st.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And also joining us is Molly Park, a reporter at the Southern Illinoisan in Carbondale. That newsroom has also had furloughs in recent weeks. Molly, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So, David, I want to begin with you. What sort of furloughs or cuts are happening at the Tribune? What were employees told?
So we are right now in the middle of the staff, the union, the News Guild staff, taking 3 weeks of unpaid furloughs, stretching from the last couple of weeks of May through July. And this took several weeks to negotiate with the union. They wanted, the company wanted to impose permanent pay cuts on the staff, ranging from 2% to 10% based on what your salary was. And there's a number of non-union members of the staff who were editors who, that's the deal they got. They took permanent pay cuts. And we decided to push back and try and get furloughs, which, you know, under the current rules, we can apply for unemployment because of the pandemic sort of bonus that the government is offering. It sort of lessens the impact on individuals taking the furloughs. But, you know, over the last several years, the Tribune staff has really been gutted, and we're down to 140 union members in our bargaining unit. And so losing, you know, a third of the staff in any given week over this time period is really sort of devastating.
And do you, I don't know if you know this number off the top of your head, but I mean, you mentioned 140 staff. What would the Tribune's headcount have been, say, I don't know, 15 years ago?
Yeah, I can tell you that when I started at the Tribune in 1999, and it was north of 750 back then. And you know, that was an era when we had numerous foreign bureaus. We had several national bureaus. We had a Washington, D.C. bureau that had you know, at least a dozen people in it. So that, you know, it's a completely different media landscape than it was decades ago. But, you know, even I double checked with the leader of the guild this morning what the number was. And, you know, I think in the last year, we've probably lost close to 100 people.
Wow.
Just through attrition, not through layoffs, but through people leaving. For myriad reasons, you know, it gets for the younger people on staff, it gets harder and harder to make a living. Pay, you know, there's just nowhere to go, and the pay has gotten pretty lousy.
Molly, what about you? What about, what are furloughs like at the Southern Illinoisan?
The Southern Illinoisan is part of the Lee Enterprise newspaper chain, and across the chain, and including at the Southern Illinoisan, we have been asked to take 2 weeks of unpaid leave or furlough. We're all kind of in the process of doing that now in the Southern Illinois, and we're just a really small newsroom. We've got three full-time reporters on the news side and two and a half writers, you know, two full-time, one part-time writer on the sports side, and that's it. So pretty tight. And so when one person goes on furlough on the news side, for instance, that leaves two reporters instead of three. So we're rotating those. I just took my first one last week or week before last, and then I take another one in June, and my colleagues are spreading theirs out as well.
Wow. And I presume at the Southern that has been just like at the Tribune. And I used to work for the State Journal Register newspaper in Springfield. Just 12 years ago, they were 10 of us editors and reporters in the features department, and now I think it's down to zero, and the entire newsroom is basically about 10 people who do writing. There are a couple of photographers as well on staff. Has that been the case at the Southern? Just attrition over the last decade or two?
Oh, yeah, certainly. And, you know, every department we have, you know, we've had, and we're, of course, much smaller. We always were. We're a more rural region. But yeah, I mean, we've had two photographers when I started just 5 years ago at this paper. We're down to one photographer. You know, we had seven reporters, which seems now looking back on it like a dream. And, and now we have three full-time writers. And so, yeah, it just seems like every time someone leaves, we always, of course, cross our fingers and hope we're able to rehire them. And I know there are efforts going on within our newsroom to hopefully be able to do that. You know, there was a plan to, I think, of course, I can't speak for management, but there was hope of rehiring that fourth reporter who had just recently left. And then the pandemic, of course, changed the financial landscape. All of that is put on hold while we complete our furloughs. And then who knows sort of what the financial picture we're looking at. I mean, we really, in this small region, you know, we really sort of have just, you know, we're really tapped into the economy and the economy of restaurants and small businesses and, you know, things that are sort of ancillary to SIU. And so when those things suffer, we're right there. We're right there with the small businesses. We are a small business, and, mm-hmm. and we feel the pain just as much as they do.
So Kristen Hare with Pointer, the Pointer Institute, I want to bring you into the conversation. You have been tracking this all over the country. I wonder, are you seeing any sort of patterns when it comes to layoffs and furloughs now?
What we're really seeing is a pattern that we've seen for the last decade, and it's accelerating. What your other guests are talking about, Pew Research found that between 2008 and 2019, newspapers shrunk by 51%, that newsroom employees shrunk by 51%. And I have seen that, you know, pre-pandemic and visiting local newsrooms, where they were a third to a quarter of the size that they once were. So layoffs have always been, you know, coverage of layoffs and furloughs has always been part of my job, unfortunately. And beginning in March with the pandemic shutting down, you know, much of the economy, that just accelerated. So what we have seen in the time since then was, you know, kind of a rolling wave that started with pay cuts, furloughs, layoffs, and I have a separate list that I'm tracking of newsrooms that have closed, which is now more than 30. And so it's all moving a lot faster than it has before, but this is all a trend that we have seen in local journalism for a long time.
And are there any newspaper layoffs or closures that have been particularly troubling to you?
I have been looking into, they're all troubling.
Yeah.
I'm going to just say they're all troubling. And what's particularly troubling, it's devastating in regular times not to have, people who will go to cover city council, who will find out what's happening in the school board, who will cover local sports, you know, who will tell you what's happening in your community when there is no one else to do that. But now we're living in a time where I think more and more people are realizing that local news isn't, a thing that's nice to have. It's a thing that you must have. I want to know here in Florida where I live, what is the death rate? What is the infection rate? What's happening to my schools? And I count on my local public radio station, my local newspaper for those things and check them frequently. So it's now a matter of life and death. I think it always has been, but it's clearer now. So generally, this is disturbing. It's disturbing that there are journalists who are furloughed, and I get emails regularly. I'm trying to reach somebody and they're on their furlough week. That aren't out covering what's happening. And now you add in this layer of the protests that we're seeing around the country, and we need people to show us what's happening and to tell the stories of the protesters, why they're out there, you know, what is their community response. And I'm emailing newsrooms right now to find out what are they gonna do about furloughs when this is a really critical story to tell at a time unlike any other we've had in this country.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking about the layoffs and furloughs that have come to the news industry, the newspaper industry in particular, as the country has had to deal with the pandemic and the resulting economic crisis from that. David Heinzman with the Chicago Tribune. I mean, I wonder if you can talk about, as these furloughs have gone into place, what sort of reporting and stories have been lost? How has this affected day-to-day coverage?
One of the things when the coronavirus pandemic hit as a story for us to cover, it was suddenly all hands on deck to cover that. And, you know, as time goes on, there are other things going on that we might include in our coverage, but when there's something really pressing like that, suddenly it takes everything we've got to cover it. And, I think one of the things we're trying to figure out now is at what point do we try to peel some people off to go back to some semblance of what they were doing. And another thing, I used to cover the police department a long time ago. And, you know, back then when you covered big demonstrations, which could get dangerous and violent, you had such a large number of staff on the street, like helping each other and supporting each other. Like during the NATO demonstrations in 2012, we had a couple of reporters who basically drove an SUV around town in case reporters got into a mess and needed to get out. And as I watched, I was furloughed this past week, so I was kind of out of the mix this weekend. But as I watched these really young reporters out on the street for us, the photographer was knocked down and robbed of her cameras, and but they were really out there on their own, and that's a little more frightening, to watch unfold, because we just don't have the staff to cover things in the way that we would have in the past. But in general, yes, you know, our staffing level depleted. There's a lot of stuff that we can't cover in the way that we used to. We were uncovered in Springfield for a long time when we were in between reporters, and You know, our staffing level was down there. And also the attrition that's happened because people, as the newsroom becomes more unstable, more people make the decision to go when they can. And so that turnover has led to sort of less continuity, I guess, and less growth. And you're not teaching the next generation of reporters in such a consistent way that we used to take over these big, important key beats.
Molly, same question to you. Are there stories being lost in Southern Illinois with reporters having to take time off?
Well, absolutely. And there's the stories that I know we're not getting to because I keep a list of, you know, people calling me, asking me, you know, can you please look into this? Can you please examine what's going on with this? Whether it's related to COVID or some sort of other type of complaint, a business closing that might employ 100 people in a rural county, that would just be devastating. And I have a list of things that I just try to get to when I can. So those are the stories I know aren't getting covered. And then of course, there's just the untold numbers of stories that we don't even know about because we can't be at the city council meetings, at the events. We don't have the manpower to even find out what the stories are. We know about the ones that where people are reaching out to us, but that's not how you work a beat, as anyone knows that has covered a city. You're there, you're talking to people every day, or Southern Illinois University. When we have two reporters, especially with the COVID pandemic, we're all hands on deck doing that. And so many other things I know are slipping through the cracks that we just don't have the manpower for right now. And mm-hmm. So it's really disheartening.
And it's not just a question, I guess, of people not being there, but I know in Springfield here at the State Journal Register, Gannett Gatehouse, the parent company, wants to move the local deadline up to 4 p.m. So no news that happens after 4 p.m. would be in the next day's paper. Kristen Hare, just a couple of minutes left. I wanted to ask you, what is at stake when local reporters are let go or asked to retire early or take furloughs, whether it's during a pandemic or even during the normal times?
There's so many things. That's a great question. Doesn't feel like it's the most important thing, but you lose institutional knowledge about your community. Every place that I've worked, including I spent 5 years in St. Louis at the St. Louis Beacon, and I worked with, you know, people who came over from the Post-Dispatch and had institutional knowledge about covering St. Louis that I, as a young reporter, would have taken me years to earn. And so you're losing people who understand the history of a place. You're also losing some basic things that are fundamental for a democracy, holding people that are powerful and, you know, where taxpayer money is going to account, shining light in those places. There have been studies that have shown that when we don't have local journalism, fewer people vote, and partisanship increases because people are getting their news mostly from national television. So, you know, and then just as a community, no one is going to cover you. No one is going to tell the stories of what's happening where you live like your local newsrooms will. It's not their job to. It's their job to parachute in, as we saw with Ferguson, when there's something bad happening. And we need all the news all the time. That matters to our communities. That's what makes us, you know, communities, places that we live together and share. So I think we lose so much. And it's not that that can't be replaced by newer, you know, models and things, mm-hmm. but it takes a long time for those things to get up and running. And the institutional power of newsrooms and newspapers in particular is really important.
Okay. David, just about 30 seconds. Last question to you. What would you like to see happen at the Tribune?
I would like to see ownership follow. You know, it feels to us like there is a path out of this, and that's the path, not just to the New York Times and the Washington Post, to some degree, the Minneapolis Star Tribune, which I think now has a larger newsroom than us, of investing in, people are going to have to pay for the news they get, but it's got to be worth it to them. And the more we cut, the less it seems like it's worth it to them. So building up your newsrooms again, investing in the future, investing in covering, covering what matters to people in those communities. We have to get to that point where we can make a persuasive case to readers, we are worth it. And yeah. It seems like our ownership is treating the Tribune more like a financial instrument that can be stripped and used for short-term profits then.
All right. Well, I'm afraid we have to leave it there. David Heinzman is with the Chicago Tribune. We also spoke with Molly Parker from the Southern Illinoisan and Kristen Hare from Pointer. This is the 21st. More to come in a moment. Thanks for tuning into the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Lucianne Walkowicz is among the most public faces in astronomy today. In between their research at the Adler Planetarium, Walkowicz has given several TED Talks on the ethics of Mars exploration, has co-founded an organization that advocates for a more inclusive and ethical future in space, and even had an asteroid named after them. Again, that is Lucianne Walkowicz. Luciana Vega is an 11-year-old interested in going to space camp and becoming the first Mars astronaut. More specifically, Luciana is the 2018 American Girl Doll of the Year. The 18-inch doll retails for more than $100 and comes with an optional telescope and Starry Night accessory pack for an extra fee. Now, real-life astronomer Lucianne Walkowicz has filed a trademark lawsuit against Mattel and American Girl, alleging that the toy maker stole Walkowicz's likeness for the doll. Last week, I was able to speak with Lucianne Walkowicz over Zoom. Her attorney, Charles Lee Mudd Jr., was also on the line. Lucianne Walkowicz, welcome to the 21st. We're glad to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me, Brian.
So, Lucianne, before the Luciana doll came to your attention, what was your knowledge of the American Girl doll product line?
I guess I would say mostly just knowing about them from when I was a kid. I didn't personally have them, but I knew friends that did.
When did you first notice the Luciana Vega doll? How did this come to your attention?
Well, so dolls are not super on my radar. I don't have young children. but it was basically immediately brought to my attention because friends and family started sending me the doll. The American Girl Doll of the Year comes out with a press release, and there was a post about it on the American Girl website. And what happened was that people started sending it to me in texts and posting it on Facebook and thought it was me.
When you first became aware of it, did you feel like there was anything you could do about it? What was your gut reaction to it?
I mean, I felt upset, first of all, because I looked at the doll and it has so many resemblances to me that go beyond the name, it seemed very clearly to be based on my likeness and my, not just my physical likeness, but my career. And I really had no idea what to do. Mattel and American Girl are giant companies. I don't really know any, I know a bit about space law, but it's not tremendously applicable in this case. So I really sort of felt, I guess the word is helpless, in that I just didn't even know what my options were. Fortunately, a friend of mine who actually works in intellectual property also has young children, and we by coincidence had been talking about getting coffee, and she, it didn't work out. And then after the holidays, she went away and came back, and there in her in her mailbox waiting for her was what appeared to be a doll of me. And so she reached out to me and said, did you authorize this? And I said, no.
Can you walk us through some of those characteristics of the doll that did get your attention? You described a resemblance or a likeness to some of your own, I guess, personal trademarks, you might say.
Yeah. Obviously the name is a big one. Doll's name is Luciana. My name is Lucianne. The actual physical appearance of the doll is also extremely similar to me. I have dark hair, and I, since probably about 2004 or 5, have had usually a streak of bright color, most often purple, in it. The doll has brown hair with a purple streak. The doll has a space printed dress that is extremely, a pink version, essentially, of a dress that I own. The doll also has shoes that are fairly unique to me. They're these sort of holographic, shiny boots that I own several pairs of. The doll also has resemblances to my career. So Vega, while being a last name, is also the name of the brightest star in the region of space that I study. So I've worked for many years on NASA's Kepler mission, which looks for planets. and points at a region between the constellations of Cygnus and Lyra, and Vega is the brightest star in that region of the sky. It's also an extremely significant star to astronomy. It's essentially like a wayfinding post. So, you know, when I give public talks, I often point out where the part of the sky is that Kepler looks at so that people can go out and appreciate that, you know, that's the place you can see with your eyes that we found all of these exciting new planets.
Hmm.
In addition to that, I heard that you mentioned the space accessories pack. The doll also has a Mars exploration playset that you can buy. And the other aspect of my research is that I work on the ethics of human exploration of Mars. And, you know, there aren't that many astronomers in the world to begin with. But I think, to the best of my knowledge, I'm the only person who works on both things related to the Kepler mission and to human exploration of Mars. Typically in astronomy, people either work sort of in the solar system or out of it. So it's relatively rare for someone to think about human exploration and also, you know, exploring very distant planets.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. My guest is astronomer Lucianne Walkowicz. In April, Walkowicz filed a trademark lawsuit against toy maker Mattel and American Girl, alleging that the company stole their likeness for the company's 2018 Girl of the Year doll, Luciana Vega. So, Lucianne, as we heard, this doll was American Girl's 2018 Girl of the Year, and that was a few years ago at this point, but I wonder, when did you make the decision to file the lawsuit, and what made you want to take that step?
Well, you know, I don't think that, well, first of all, it is not permissible for a company to take my likeness, my physical likeness and career and monetize it. I didn't give my permission, and, you know, that's not okay. I also think it's a really bad example for young women who, you know, the doll is marketed as being something that is aspirational. And, you know, I can't think of a worse way to treat someone's career as something that can just be taken and used for the profits of these companies, Mattel and American Girl. So the reason it's taken a while has just been that, first of all, I didn't really know what my options were to begin with, you know, since then I've been working on, you know, trying to essentially gather pieces of evidence of what could have happened that led to this. You know, there are also several talks that I've given less than 10 miles from the American Girl headquarters. So understanding the timeline was part of it. And also, you know, reaching out to legal folks like Charles. So I'm not walking around suing people. I don't really know, like I said, anything beyond, you know, the Outer Space Treaty. So it was really, I would say, a long process rather than a moment of decision of understanding what the options were and, you know, trying to see how I could take action.
I wonder if you've, obviously there is a lot of effort underway in our society to try and increase STEM opportunities, that's science, technology, engineering, and math opportunities for young women and girls. And I'm sure there are people out there who think, well, this is a positive thing, right? This is trying to encourage young women to become astronomers, which, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but I understand is still a fairly not representational field, more men than women in that field. I wonder if you've gotten any sort of negative feedback from anyone about the lawsuit, or have people, how have they responded?
You know, I would actually say that the feedback has been overwhelmingly positive. I've including folks that are actually collectors of American Girl dolls, you know, whose interest is in the dolls rather than scientists. So they might not have known about me, but I've received a number of messages of people who acknowledge that, you know, the doll bears so many resemblances to me. You know, Charles is often fond of saying, well, one thing, you know, maybe it's an accident. Two things, well, less likely. All of these things, you know, even people who are fans of American Girl are, I think, hopeful that the company will make it right, because it is so clear cut, at least, you know, to my mind, obviously. it's so clear cut that it is based on a real person.
And I do want to note here that we did reach out to the American Girl Doll Company for comment about the lawsuit. They responded with a statement, quote, "American Girl takes great pride in creating original characters for girls. We take any allegations to the contrary extremely seriously and intend to defend the case vigorously. As it is our policy not to comment on pending litigation, we can't comment further," unquote. Lucianne, I know you're limited in terms of what you can say, but what are you hoping will come of the lawsuit?
I think my primary hope is that they stop, first of all, using my identity, and also that they don't do this to other scientists. You know, if they create original characters, then that's wonderful. But to take someone's career and likeness and turn it into a product that benefits them is really not okay.
And I want to ask you, sort of taking a step back from this case, about the field of astronomy. Have you found it to be a welcoming place in your career? Can you talk about that aspect of your work in science?
Yeah, I'd be happy to offer some thoughts. You know, I think I would say that the representation issues in astronomy are fairly complicated and nuanced. You know, a lot of focus goes into, you know, quote, getting girls interested in STEM. In my experience, a lot of people are interested in STEM, but we have persistent harassment issues that drive people out of the field all the time and continue to do so. There's been a fair amount of progress for white women in STEM over the past several years, where a lot of astronomy departments at the graduate level or undergraduate level have essentially gender parity, but you know, you see fewer and fewer women as you ascend to higher ranks, and that seems to be persistent. And while there's been progress for white women, the field of astronomy is still overwhelmingly white. So there has been less progress for women of color in the field as well, because of course, you know, women of color face not only gender-based harassment, but racial harassment. You know, and these, I'll point out that these issues are not unique to astronomy or unique to STEM at all. It's that, you know, astronomy, even though we deal with things that are in space, we're still an Earth-based science. And that means that we face all of the barriers to inequality that are out there in the world at large. You know, I'm happy to see that amongst my colleagues, there are a lot of people who are working for change and working to make astronomy a more welcoming place. And, you know, I certainly don't want to speak to everybody's experiences. You know, people are not monolithic blocks and they all have different experiences of individuals being welcoming or not. But, you know, we still have the same barriers that are out there in the world at large. And we're gradually making progress. And I hope that we continue to do so.
All right, Lucianne, before we let you go, I did want to ask about one more thing unrelated to the lawsuit. And the day after Adler celebrated its 90th birthday earlier this month, the planetarium laid off 120 part-time and full-time employees. And I think as somebody who's been there as a tourist, I don't know if everyone realizes just how much research is done there. And obviously you yourself are a working scientist at Adler. I wonder, are you still working there?
Yes, I am still at the Adler Planetarium. You know, Adler is very unique. It's a unique place in that it has a research astronomy component in addition to its sort of public-facing side, the planetarium that you can visit and enjoy all the programs of. You know, there are very, very few places that are like that, that actually have this sort of research side of astronomy and, you know, mission that is geared towards bringing people who aren't scientists into the fold and sharing the wonders of discovery with them. So it's a great institution, and you know, these are hard times for everyone.
Lucianne Walkowicz is an astronomer at the Adler Planetarium in Chicago. Lucianne, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today on the 21st.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's all we have time for today, but a couple of housekeeping notes before we go. First, we want to take a moment to welcome back our listeners at Peoria Public Radio, WCBU-FM. We're glad to have you with us, and as ever, we'd love to hear what you think about what you heard on the show or what you think we should be talking about. You can tweet us at 21STShow, that's at 21stShow, or send an email to talk@21stShow.org. And the second thing is, as we enter a new phase of this coronavirus pandemic, you can help us shape our news coverage by joining our new texting initiative. We're calling it Text the 21st. You can text the word TALK to 217-803-0730 to join the conversation. The first question we're posing is, if you could go back to the start of 2020 and give yourself some pre-coronavirus advice, what would it be? Just text NEWS to 217-803-0730 and let us know what your advice would be. Our program is produced by Libby Foster and Anna Casey. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Special thank you to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Brian Mackey. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Stay safe out there, and thanks for listening.